Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast,
we report back from Labour Party conference. What was the mood like? What was discussed? What policies are in the offing?
We discussed whether or not we thought Jeremy Corbyn's speech was a flop or fantastic.
I think that those are the two options, basically. And finally, you ask us, is Labour right to wargame a run on the pound? So, Stephen, you're back slightly later than me from Brighton. I made it until Monday evening in the palace of, I think it's quite a good seaside. I'm just going to put this out there. I know you said last week it wasn't, but I one of the things that's nice about having Labour conference in Brighton is that weirdly September as a month is often a lot warmer and nicer than you think. So I arrived in the afternoon of, well, actually I arrived first thing on Sunday morning to do the Sunday politics, and that was it was a really beautiful day, and I felt my heart was lifted.
So Brighton is lovely, and the weather was lovely, and the sea is lovely, but to my mind, and I know that it's not a proper seaside record.
Shingle is bullshit, that's what you're saying.
Well, yeah, I just basically, like, for it to be a seaside, there's got to be, you know, a beach, whereas really there's buildings, you know, nice buildings, and some nice cafes, and then there's sea, right? There's, you know, there's... The essential ingredient to me of a seaside is not
the side.
Up here. Yeah, it's the side, right?
Like, okay. Yeah. But the other thing that was is that I guess it's a kind of pathetic fallacy. I was surprised by how nice the atmosphere was. Yes, there were times when I think it tipped into a slightly weird triumphalism from a party that did not actually win in June. But it's one of those things that you kind of step off the, you know, Facebook, Twitter echo chamber, and you remember that most Labour activists, you know, I think you've talked about this before, you know, the kind of median Corbyn supporting activist is just so much nicer, more pleasant, more open to, you know, there's not, yes, they might cheer the anti-mainstream media lines in the speech, and there were a lot of those this year again, but they're not kind of frothingly hating of journalists in the way that you would perhaps get that impression off something like Twitter.
Yeah, and I think it's also kind of the problem, of course, well, I mean, with the internet, but life in general, is that one remembers exceptional events and striking events, i.e. in the case of Twitter, rudeness and unpleasantness.
I think that's true, but I also think there's a really powerful crowd effect. Like, if you're chairing a fringe and someone says something rude and unpleasant, actually you get the sense from everyone else in the room of, well, that's a bit not on, we've all come here, you know, and these people are giving up their time, yeah. Which is using what, you know, you just don't get that kind of, even if sort of silent wave of disapproval that you kind of get in a real life space. Anyway, enough of me blathering on about the fact that everyone was surprisingly pleasant to me, and I didn't buy any, there was quite a lot of Corbyn merch, wasn't there? You mentioned this in your column.
Yes, I did. Several party staffers have complained, not in the kind of, you know, but have kind of said, like, it is a shame that they have not trademarked Corbyn's likeness, because a great deal of Corbyn merch was selling like hotcakes. Obviously, the official Labour Party store sells,
for the many, not the few,
a great number of, and also, like, they sell a Corbyn tote bag, yada yada. So they also are on the kind of Corbyn merch.
The only thing I was tempted by was there was a crazy cat lady boutique that said, "I'm voting El Gato." And that was the only one that nearly tempted me. But then I thought, look at yourself.
But the thing is,
what are you doing?
But yeah, so there's a feeling in Labour's fundraising team, it's not necessarily, they know that there are lots of reasons why Jeremy Corbyn would not permit them to start issuing cease and desist letters to kind of sort of. But like, you know, there's a Corbyn Toby jug, and they're just like, well, you know, we wanted to do a Toby jug. But yeah, there was. I was talking with some Labour MPs and peers late last night about it. It's definitely the kind of most happy festival atmosphere of a conference I can remember covering, and they kind of thought in the last time the Labour conference had that kind of optimism and get up and go about it was 2007, Gordon Brown's first conference as leader, speculation that he was going to, you know, use his large opinion poll lead to go for an early election.
Is that the one that then got crushed by Osborne standing up a week later and announcing the inheritance tax cut?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll look forward to next week's Tory conference. Although I suspect that that will be as dominated by Brexit as this one has been.
I think more so. I mean, the slight weirdness of this Labour Party conference was you have this thing where people would keep asking me how it was being covered, because obviously they're too busy to actually check it themselves. So they might have read my free morning email, Morning Call, which you can subscribe to on the website. They might have been reading that, but they weren't. People say, oh, well, how is it being covered elsewhere? And I go, well, it's not really, to be honest. The main story is the disintegration of the Tory party. And I think that disintegration will be thrown into still sharper relief in their own conference, because the dog that has not yet barked in terms of the Conservatives' pain over Brexit are Conservative Remainers, right? Mm. If you are Nicky Morgan, right, you're looking at Boris Johnson popping up and going, rah-bah-ha, rah-bah-bah-bah-bah-bah-bah, yeah, no Norway stumble. Then, in fact, actually, if you are a Leaver who wanted a Norway option, you're also not that thrilled.
But I agree with you, because there were a lot of Labour MPs, I felt, who either stayed away altogether from Labour conference or kept an extremely low profile, didn't really particularly speak at fringes or anything like that. So, actually, the number of people talking about, you know, the single market and things like that and expressing unhappiness with Labour's fudge was relatively low, but it's a bit more of a critical issue for Tory Remainers.
Yeah, I mean, also, I think in some ways the row over Labour's Brexit policy is a bit of a red herring, and this can be one of those occasions where I'm going to use the word leadership and Labour to mean two slightly different things, because there's an awful lot of focus on what the leadership's policy is, and obviously their official policy is basically to have a deep breath and then have a slightly less hard Brexit than the Conservatives, and the customs union in particular is very important in terms of the options as far as the Irish border go, but to then have a fairly drastic breach from the European Union. But if Jeremy Corbyn turned around tomorrow and went, actually, my position is to fight for our membership of the single market, a large chunk of Labour MPs who are currently voting with party policy would start voting against party policy. So that's the Labour position, as opposed, the Labour position is to have a hard Brexit. You know, to hope they can get some kind of deal on immigration, which means they don't have to have a hard Brexit. But basically it's to have a hard Brexit because they think they need to have some kind of action on free movement of labour. And even the people who are incredibly pro-immigration, there is quite a large number of people who basically are like, look, but we clearly fought a referendum going, the economy will fall in if you restrict immigration. People went, well, we want to restrict immigration, therefore we can't go, well, no, the economy will fall in, so we're going to stay in the single market.
For me, one of the really interesting things, and you've picked up on it in your kind of five things you've learned from conference, is the change in attitude of business. So I did the Federation of Small Businesses Fringe with John McDonnell, Shadow Chancellor, and it was striking how much of a rapport there was between him and Martin McTague, as the elected head of that organisation. You know, they've had lots of conversations, quite obviously, and actually he was up on the details of things about productivity and the problems we have there, about, you know, 5G coverage, about super fast broadband, all that kind of stuff that actually is incredibly dull to most people, but in terms of businesses asks. And actually we were talking about, you know, the corporation tax, whether or not there'll be an exemption for small businesses, or from the rise from in corporation tax from 19% to 26%, or whether or not that would be, you know, it would be a much lower rise as was set out in the manifesto. It did also, however, point to a slight issue with Labour's offer at the last election, which was that Corbyn went to the Federation of Small Business Conference in April and said, oh, it's going to stay at 19% for small businesses. It'll only be for big businesses. It'll rise. And then the Labour manifesto said that it would rise for small businesses. So there, what, and I think I can think of several other examples like that. You know, and to be fair to them, they put that manifesto together in a tearing hurry. And actually, there wasn't really time in that short campaign to scrutinise Labour's policy stuff in really gritty detail, and no one kind of thought that it mattered, really. You know, the whole election was fought on the basis that, you know, we didn't really need to interrogate each promise because they weren't going to happen. And I don't think that will be the same next time.
Well, no, I mean, that's going to be the other interesting thing about the NEC, which is now back to hung, because at this conference a new chair and deputy chair were elected. the chair is a more valuable piece as far as the NEC and voting whether or not things are out of order than it is than having the majority on there. So there is now a Corbynite chair and deputy chair, which means that their two-vote lead has turned into a hung one. But as our expectation is that the Corbynites will sweep the board in the three extra NEC places, which will be elected in the autumn, further on in the autumn. Then that majority will be restored. And in any case, the strategic interest of most of the swing voters on the NEC is to vote with the leadership where possible. So actually there is kind of a Corbynite majority.
Which ties anyway into another big story of this conference, and I think it's something that both you and I have touched on and stuff that we've written about, the organisational heft of Corbyn's wing of the party now, particularly Momentum, in terms of their app building was exceptional. They had a conference app which, you know, told you which motions to vote for. It gave you a really good guide to all the fringe listings. All the kind of stuff that you would think would have been done already and done really well by a party. And yet, you know, you're still relying on kind of printed booklets, really.
Well, Labour do have a conference app. It's just very slow. And obviously, because it's the official one, you can't use it to do whipping. I do think there's been a little bit of kind of scoreboard journalism, and I've probably engaged in some of it myself, about Momentum's organisational successes. There are lots of places which have elected delegates who came to vote for the rule changes, who might be pro-European but didn't want to vote on Brexit because they voted with the Momentum line on Brexit because they knew then it would trigger a pain point for the party and for Jeremy Corbyn, and they wanted that not to happen. Where actually, in those parts of the country, Momentum is a bit of a shambles, to be frank, right? There are large parts of it where, because it kind of has semi by accident developed a kind of quasi parallel structure with the rest of the Labour Party. So you have like.
Yeah, but I think what they did with that Brexit vote is that they made it look like that to having not having that vote was the Corbyn loyalist thing to do. They got that message out very successfully, and that's what you're talking about, which is what affected other people who then thought, we think the next election is going to be four or five years away, so why would we have this pointless discussion that's only going to expose our divisions?
Yeah, but my point is the Momentum centrally is very well organised, but in an odd way, the only reason why it mattered that they had got out what the Corbyn loyalists thing was is they had already done a very good job at winning delegate elections, where actually, although the centre of Momentum is well organised, the periphery is not. You can see that in one of the other interesting sort of straws in the wind about, you know, the balance of power in Labour. Local councillors are at the moment being reselected because all local councillors in Labour have to go through a mandatory reselection process. I mean, obviously so do Labour MPs, but an open reselection process. It's easier to deselect a councillor. And actually very few of them have been, including councillors who are in places where, because of their budget cuts, they have been having to do fairly right-wing things anyway, although there are some places where we expect there will be a large chunk of deselections, Haringey being one. But yeah, I think some of it is actually just about the ideological shift in some parts of the country in the Labour Party. Though obviously the fact that their app is very good, that they do have far and away, I'd say, the most impressive set of staff, the best messaging of any faction at the moment. But yeah.
And a huge amount of energy and a huge amount of just digital skills in terms of that they've got, you know, young, interested people who are running on enthusiasm. And I think, you know, I went down to them, a couple of different of the Momentum spaces, and, you know, it was really impressive to see what they had going on. And I've written this week that I sort of wonder if some of the bits about the meme wall and the kind of clay pots and all that kind of stuff and the acid Corbynism session is almost deliberate in a way that they kind of quite like to feel that they're luring journalists into a sort of trap to write about them in that way, because the two ways that they could be presented are either as kind of, oh, look at these crazy young people and their, you know, and their memes, or it could be, look at this sinister hard left faction that's like all its data is owned and controlled by one guy and it's trying to take over the party. So I think probably of those two, you would always pick like acid Corbynism and lol as your public image.
The other thing to remember is that the world transformed and Momentum are increasingly separate. I was talking to a senior official in a major pro-Corbyn trade union about this, and yeah, they said, well, the great thing now is the world transformed is kind of its own set of programme.
Unite must have put a bit of money behind it, because there was lots of Unite merch there as well.
Yeah, the world transformed is basically its own separate programme of events, and then the Momentum is now, and this is one of the other reasons why they are doing better, is doing it's now doing two things much more The first, of course, which will be the thing that if you are a podcast listener, you are more likely to have seen, which is that they are effectively operating as one of the United Kingdom's first super PACs, right? They do their great shareable videos. But the other is they are acting as a factional organisation much more. So, I mean, the interesting thing is, in some ways, although the politics of all the people involved are the same, the events team and the politics stuff are increasingly separate.
Okay, well, we'll come back after this and talk about Jeremy Corbyn's speech specifically.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So let's talk about Jeremy Corbyn's speech, which kind of capped Labour Party conference, shall we say. Okay, tell me if I'm being unfair. It was too long. It had a bit too much of, you're great, no, you're great now. Here's another person who's great, you're great. Which I guess was cathartic and necessary. Like, that was in tune with the feeling of the conference, which was like, let's all get together and celebrate the fact we didn't get walloped like we thought we were going to get walloped. But there was a strange thing of going through the conference of re-announcing stuff that was in the manifesto with a slight sort of idea as if it was new and just set. And the idea was that just being able to say it more confidently was kind of the story. So the nationalisation stuff, for example, got a lot of write-ups, but that was all in the manifesto. And lots of the stuff that Jeremy Corbyn announced today about housing was kind of edging towards that in the manifesto, although not. I don't think he specifically promised rent controls, or I think...
Rent control is new.
Ed Miliband had a kind of version of that, which
they
I...
had kind of fair stuff for renters, and I mean...
And they did other stuff for renters too, right?
I don't want to get pulled into the rent control tech yet, because I'll just vanish into a weird rabbit warren about housing policy.
Wasn't the speech quite Miliband-y, though?
But the thing is, I think that's because the conference speech format is innately bad. Corbyn has only done... Well, so this was his best performance. However, in terms of the actual speech, I'd say Corbyn has only done one good one, which was last year's.
It wasn't bad. I mean, that was the thing. It was... He delivered it in a totally plausible, competent way, which, given from somebody who's only been leader for 2 years and kind of came from nowhere, is... Like, he has been a quick learner in that sense of those leadership skills.
And Ed, I think, only really did...
Predators versus Producers was quite good.
Predators versus Producers was good. It actually did work and have a beginning, middle... Because the problem is because... So one of the good changes that the leadership brought in last year was moving it to the last day, which means you don't have that weird thing of Labour conference kind of sort of like...
Dribbling away.
Mm. And that does mean there's more energy around the last day and there's sort of energy around the leader's speech. However, the leader's speech is still too long to do well, particularly if... How can I put this? Particularly if your political style is not one of a political explainer, as it were, right? Blair was very good at conference speeches because he basically would do the like, here is the issue, and the issue is this, and this is the challenge, and as a result of the challenge, we do X. And Ed was very good at doing conference speeches because he was very wonkish. So he'd do the kind of like, here is the problem, and as so-and-so says, and so-and-so, and how do we bring these together, right? Gordon Brown was very good at the shorter Chancellor slot because he basically did them like a sermon. And yeah, and that worked very well. Like, there's a reason why, you know, organised religion has gone on for so long. The sermon format works.
There were some good bits in Corbyn's speech,
but Gordon
though.
Brown never did, with the exception of the financial crisis speech where he basically got to do like a big, like, I'm going to explain what's going on, never really did a good conference speech because the format is too long.
But the best parts of the Corbyn speech were the bit about extractive capitalism and the bit about Grenfell and Grenfell kind of standing as a monument to a broken society. And I thought he framed that, which is his, you know, his and John McDonnell's premise about what they want to do with the Labour Party, quite well, right? Which is that they don't want to just nibble around the edges of capitalism. They want to fundamentally involve the state more in people's lives. And because they think that will mean that, you know, that actually that will, they think that will mean greater control for people and greater democratic accountability. So having a state-run water company, for example, means that you know who to complain to when something goes wrong. And actually it's maximising value for customers rather than for shareholders. And I thought he did quite a good job of explaining that stuff, like why his statist vision is, as he sees it, kind of populist and giving power back to ordinary people.
Yeah, I mean, I think... Like I said, all of those caveats I just had aside, in terms of for a genre of speech, I don't think it can actually ever really work. Or at least doesn't work unless you have two very specific styles of giving a speech. I think it didn't work as well as it is possible for it not to work. I don't think it didn't work whereas last year's, I think, actually worked, but it's hard to do that again. I think the interesting thing in terms of the policy stuff, so the rent control stuff is new. I haven't looked again at the detail yet.
Well, I'm a bit worried about the rent control stuff because Shelter, I think, are a bit queasy on it. And actually lots of left-wing economists are a bit about it. And also that his talk about gentrification I find quite worrying, because he was talking about saying we want communities to have to approve new developments. Well, I kind of see the point of that as a policy lever, because the obvious example is somewhere like the Haygate estate in Elephant Castle, essentially, where people got chucked out with the promise that this new development was going to bring all this great stuff to them. And whatever we're going to say, Section 120, all the stuff about the requirement for new affordable housing gets whittled away. And actually what you end up happening is a lot of people get evicted from their homes and long-established communities, and basically a kind of load of yuppies move in. So I kind of see the premise of that, and I do agree with him with that. But one of the massive problems that we have with housing in this country is essentially the fact, the veto that people already have through the planning system, and the fact that nebulously 200,000 people need a house is up against the fact that 50 people who already have a house can, you know, fight every step of the way to stop more housing being built next to them. So I'm concerned about that as a policy challenge.
Yeah, I mean, the odd thing about it is oddly similar to the Adam Smith Institute's proposals for planning reform, where you can see what they're both doing is you tackling the same problem, right? Which is basically the average British person wants to live in a townhouse, right? They're happy not to live in all of a townhouse, but they want to live in a six-story...
Like a mansion block, right? They don't want to live in a high-rise.
Yeah,
they don't want to live in a flat.
Six-story, kind of quasi-Georgian-style townhouse. Now, the brilliant thing is, because our housing density is so low, you can actually achieve this aspiration for most people and have a mixture of social and rented housing, and et cetera, and fix the housing market that way as a building solution. The problem that both the ASI and Corbyn have grappled with, and they both come to a weirdly similar solution, is this problem of the local veto. Now, weirdly, both of them seem to come like, well, we'll give people a vote, but we'll give them some guarantees, and then magic will happen, and these things will be passed. My concern, practically, with the Corbyn policy is it won't work the way that he thinks it will. That actually, mostly in places where the assurances have not been met about, oh, you will be able to move back in. Oh, I know when I said you will be able to move back into something else in the same area. By something else similar, I meant something completely different. And by
in
the
Kent.
Same area, I meant Kent. Yeah. And basically, my instinct is I can't think of an example of any of the abuses of the current system where I don't think the assurances given before would have been enough for people not to vote on it. Unless your opinion, and I can see how some people would say this about both the ASI and Corbyn schemes, isn't actually if you give people a vote, they are just not going to. I mean, housing is one of the things where I just do sort of go for the like full-on status thing, that actually the only way to guarantee that people who already live somewhere will not lose out is for the government to quite literally force, you know, something with the exact same dimensions, etc., etc., and to, if not, build it directly themselves. At least, I just think you have to have a level of compulsion.
Yeah, that's
the
trouble, is I think that direct building is really... But it's phenomenally expensive. You see why they don't want to do it. But what you've ended up with, and he mentioned this, which is an Ed Miliband theme, is land banking and developers sitting on properties hoping to sort of speculate on the values going up. But also about the systematic abuse of Section 120 and about the idea that actually... You know, you kind of, no one ever offers to build more social housing because a project ended up being more profitable than they thought. Instead, they'll keep coming back and back saying, oh, can we just have a few, slightly fewer affordable homes in this development? And then all of a sudden you've got, and actually, I was looking at affordable homes in Islington when we were up in our old office. It was by the old site of the old post office there. And actually, what an affordable rent, because it's a percentage of market rent. If the market rent's loopily high, then the affordable rent is loopily high. It's not the same as a social housing rent, which is actually genuinely affordable.
To go down the rabbit warren of rent control, basically every economist thinks that rent control doesn't work. However, the thing about the speech and the word rent control is it can mean a great deal of things, right? So it, for example, can mean we're actually going to change tenants. So we're going to do some of the things that Will Tanner, former aide to Theresa May, suggested doing in his debut I column. where you basically just tilt the... Because our whole rental market is based on the idea that most of the people who rent are students and 21-year-old professionals who leave anyway. So you need to give the landlord a great deal of regulatory protection because actually the person they're renting on is going to leave anyway. And but the thing is, if you want to sell that electorally, there's a whole package of things you could do that, which if I were advising a political leader, I would say, let's just call this rent control. Then there's your actual, like, it may not rise below X percent, it must do Y, which we know has perverse outcomes and does not work the way that...
I've seen Friends.
Yeah, the way that you would think it does. However, yeah, as I've said, because it's not entirely clear from the speech and I haven't looked at the policy yet whether or not he is actually proposing actual rent control or a bit like the PFI speech where they kind of went, yeah, we'll take them all back. But actually what they meant was we'll will look through and work out which ones have got punitive break clauses and which ones don't.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting speech from the point of view of its confidence. He did a bit in the middle, like he always does the Trumpy bit in the middle where he says how beastly the MSM are. But it was luckily it was in the middle rather than at the end when he was doing stump speeches in his second leadership campaign. It always came at the beginning because it was the thing that fired up the audience. And I guess now it's a sign that he's got a lot of other applause lines that so he doesn't necessarily need to do the kind of 2-minute hate about the pundits quite as much. So that was an interesting reflection too.
I always get a bit about the Trump comparison because the thing is, right, is although there are lots of things with which I disagree about the present Labour leadership and there are lots of legitimate criticisms to be made of it, ultimately the US media is not biased against the Republican Party, whereas the British media kind of is biased against the Labour Party.
The US media is definitely biased against Trump, but I would just say kind of correctly so because it just says that all of his policies are awful, his opinions are terrible, and he can't achieve any of them. But I think the mechanism of them works exactly the same way, which is about an anti-elitist message, which is another theme that went all the way through the speech is anti-elitism. And actually the media are kind of always portrayed as being part of that elite. So I think mechanistically it does a us versus them thing that is very energising.
Yeah, but, I mean, I wouldn't do it because I think, as we are now demonstrating, journalists love to talk about themselves.
Yeah.
Every second that a journalist is talking about themselves, they're not talking about your policy issues, which is where you actually move votes, etc., etc. But, yeah, it's just me.
And now a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
And this week you've asked us about the war games that Labour is doing about, which were reported as kind of John McDonnell prepares for Labour run on the pound. And I have to say, luckily I was too busy to get involved in a beef war. But I did find watching Tory MPs saying like, ho, Labour are having to prepare for what happens if they tank the pound. And I wanted to go, do you know what has genuinely actually tanked the pound? Brexit. So wind your neck in. But were they right to talk about that, Stephen?
Well, I think they were definitely right to be wargaming it. There are many, many reasons to believe that the next Labour government will inherit economic chaos. There are other reasons to believe that it may then, in of itself, just by arriving in office, be the trigger for sovereign flight and various other issues. So it makes sense to do it. So my understanding is that one of the reasons why McDonnell expressly mentioned it was that Rebecca Long-Bailey had been asked a question at a roundtable about tanking the pound, and her response was, does anyone have any other questions? Obviously, they didn't have any other questions because they were like, well, now you've conceded you don't have an answer. I think... ultimately, it's better to go, of course, we are planning for, you know, all number of contingencies. However, were I advising the Labour leadership, the other thing I would be thinking about is, given the surely Labour's best chance of taking office, and also I think just looking at the Brexit talks, the most likely outcome isn't the Brexit talks end badly and you inherit economic chaos. Obviously, in terms of getting its vote out, inspiring people, you don't want a situation where Corbyn is saying, so a large chunk of this manifesto we might not be able to do because we might just be cleaning up this mess we've inherited. But you do kind of need to start getting your counter-narrative in early. I mean, let's say, again, I think it's more likely than...
Yeah, I know what you mean. I can see a situation in which actually, do you know what, they just don't have the money to repeal tuition fees, to abolish tuition fees, right?
Yeah, and all... I mean, last thing is...
That's either a great betrayal, or you do what the Tories did very successfully to Gordon Brown and say, we're blaming it on the mess that Labour left us with.
Yeah, or if you arrive and there is, you know, a massive run on the pound because the bond markets go, John McDonnell in the Treasury, and if the bond markets, I assume, will already be feeling fairly nervous about the United Kingdom as in terms of its seaworthiness because of the way that Brexit has panned out. So there are lots and lots of things which might prevent a Labour government doing all of its things, not least if a bunch of young graduates decide to leave, then your ability to pay for the tuition fee cut by taxing upper earners vanishes if there are fewer upper earners when you come into office. So I think it makes a lot of sense to find ways of discreetly going, guys, FYI, I think the danger with specifics, and this doesn't seem to be where any of the media line of inquiry has gone yet, is it does raise the inevitable question of, well, are you wargaming the consequences of people's decision to vote to leave the European Union? Because the slight difficulty, I mean, less so for Jeremy and John themselves because of where their long-standing politics are, but for the leadership more broadly and for the kind of overall Labour Party project, is most people involved in it do not think the Brexit decision was the right one.
Not is the IFS. Which yeah. says it's going to cost us £300 million.
But the difference is the IFS doesn't have to get re-elected, right? They're one of the challenges for a Labour government, if there is as I expect one, will be not having the moment when on TV someone turns around and goes, "Yeah, but you guys voted for it, so
yeah,
what do you want from me?"
Yeah, you nodded it through. Yeah,
Yeah,
I think that makes sense. And also, I do think that it also, if the slight difficulty of their Brexit fudge position, if they were an overtly anti-Brexit party, they'd be able to say, do you know what else? The government hasn't wargamed. No deal. Like, where are these customs staff? Where are these people who are going to inspect beef at the the Channel Tunnel? But they kind of can't lean too heavily on the prospect of how terrible an idea Brexit is when they're still trying to play that one foot in each camp. But
well, I think if they were anti-Brexit party, they would have lost, Ashfield.
It's true. Yeah. So, yeah, so I think that's an answer. Yes, they were right to talk about the fact that they had war game, but probably they were wrong to go into specifics.
Yeah. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague, Helen Lewis. Our music is Devil by the Devil and is licensed by Creative Commons. Do follow all of the NS podcasts on @NSPodcasts for more podcast joys, plus a secret project coming soon from me.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.